This is The Platform Rules, Digital Transformation for Product Companies, hosted by Propel.
Welcome back to The Platform Rules. Pandemics, shipping snafus, extreme weather, all have conspired to completely upend global supply chains. When will it end? And if it won't, what can we do about it? Peter Bolello, President and CEO of SimData, the global leader in PLM consulting, joined us to chat Rule 4, Secure Your Supply Chain. Let's get to it. Here's your host, Propel CMO, Dario Ambrosini, with guest Peter Bolello.
My guest today is Peter Bolello, President and CEO of SimData. SimData is a product lifecycle management education, research, and strategic management consulting firm. So Peter, we're 2 years into the supply chain crisis and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. What's your take on where we go from here?
Well, Dario, thanks for inviting me. This discussion is very interesting and dear to my heart. The problem is it's always been a problem when it comes down to it. Certainly the pandemic has been a forcing factor for many, but there's been a number of things related to it. One is demand has changed for some companies dramatically. We saw this early on in North America, for example, a toilet paper shortage. Well, why was that the case? Well, one is people started rushing to the store and buying too much of it when they really didn't need it. But also the people that providing and you know, producing toilet paper were more used to producing a certain number or amount of rolls for industry to use or for commercial buildings, and then a certain amount for residential homes to have. And they had to all of a sudden change that because most of it was residential needs and not so much needs for the commercial building space. But then you had companies who were building exercise equipment. All of a sudden, we weren't traveling much. Travel went down significantly. So, certain industries got hammered in that regard, of course, like the hospitality industry is an example. But all of a sudden, people producing bicycles and exercise equipment all of a sudden had to increase and ramp up and build as fast as they could. So some of that has been really a forcing factor of showing some of the weaknesses that were already there. And then you had other issues come up of, the timing of where companies shut down and other companies didn't shut down, and then delays at, shipping delays. And then of course, then there's huge amounts of boats sitting out of large harbors all around the world at different times, depending on when, the production started happening in one region, but production wasn't happening in another region, for example. And then you had, a huge giant container ship sitting in the Suez Canal entry area for a period of time for about a week, if I remember correctly, which delayed a bunch of other ships. So there's a bunch of things that are all going around, some of it related to the pandemic a lot, but not all of it. But some of the fundamental issues about supply chain, how fragile it can be, have always been there, especially as we've created in a lot of the world kind of offshored or right-shored, however you want to describe that, where shipping has become so critical. Good news is containerization, there's a positive and negative about containerization. Positive is it's allowed for shipping to be a much smoother process. Before where you had unload and load and unload and unload and so on, really, became problematic and a lot of bottlenecks. Containerization's helped that a lot, but at the same time, now we got containers sitting everywhere empty. So we really have had fundamental problems underneath for various reasons. Some of it's logistics, some of it's really what we're buying, where we're buying stuff from, and a whole other host of things we could get into in this discussion. But I think the good news is the pandemic has brought a challenge, and the opposite side of a challenge is an opportunity. So hopefully companies, as they see this challenge, they'll say, okay, what do I have to do or what should I do about it so I can minimize the next disruption? And this is a lot of our clients are coming to us and saying, we know we have to change the way we think about these things. Think about the life cycle, and the life cycle part of that is what do I buy? Who do I buy it from? How do I deal with it? And all the logistics side of it and supply chain side of it. And how do I bring that together so I am more resilient against the next disruption? Because we know there will be another disruption, maybe a pandemic, and maybe all kinds of different issues that we could go into, but that's another topic. But we know disruption will happen.
So what are you recommending the clients that come to you? What are you telling them they should do to build this resilience for the future?
Well, one, figure out what they're trying to accomplish. And step back, figure out the big picture. Okay, so there's certain things that I'm good at, right? My core competency. Now, that doesn't mean a lot of companies understand what that is, but it's usually first thing you need to ask them is, what is your core competency? You know, as a company, are you going to focus on certain design aspects, let's say, different certain markets, certain production capabilities? But what really do you want to focus on as your core competency? And then what are the things that you're going to contract out? And then what kind of relationships do you want to have in those contracts? You know, do you want a contract manufacturer, which you're allowing them to do even some of the design, not just design of the manufacturing process, but maybe even design of some of the componentry, for example. And then do they own the supply chain? Or, and we have some clients like this in the high-tech world, is even though they use high, high percentage of contract manufacturers, they actually want to own the data and the quality information down the supply chain. Because they find that at the end of the day, it's their label on the product and they have to have full traceability all the way back through the suppliers, even though they're actually not working directly with the suppliers. So it kind of varies a little bit, but starting with what's the core competency, then strategically building out your supply chain architecture, which is your strategy. Again, what competencies are you looking for? What kind of relationships are you looking for? And so on, so that it becomes strategic, and then understanding then what are the bottlenecks, where are the potential issues that can have. So if I change all of a sudden what I produce or what I sell, okay, how does that ripple down the supply chain? So that also means I have to have a more holistic view of it. So, and you know, by the way, simulation can then be used, you know, real kind of software simulation saying, okay, if all of a sudden this one product, you know, let's say all of a sudden the sales double, what does that do? What's the ripple effect in my manufacturing, my sales, my supply chain? And how can I understand where those problematic areas will be? So then I can figure out buffers. So, you know, in manufacturing, we're used to doing this. If I have a bottleneck in manufacturing, I usually put a buffer of material in front of it so that it's always can be used. I don't starve the starve it. So supply chain's the same way. Where is my bottleneck? And how do I then manage against that bottleneck? And by the way, the bottlenecks can change over time. So holistic view down into the detail of building out a strategy and then focusing on those areas where the bottlenecks exist.
Okay. Okay. And you froze up on me a little bit there. I don't know if that was me or you, but okay. I got the gist though. So I think two areas here that I'd like to go into then. One, you talked a little bit about bringing in contract manufacturers and even more, you know, going down the CDMO path where, you know, maybe they're even doing some of the design work. Mm-hmm. Do you see more and more of that trend of specialization? And just to give you a little bit of context, we see a lot more CMs that start to vertically specialize. I'm going to help with, you know, medical devices, and then I'm going to go deeper on the design. I'm going to go deeper on supply chain, and I'm going to really bring a strategic advantage to my OEM by choosing me. Yeah. And then we also see more of the broad-based where they're, you know, going more verticalized versus more horizontal. We kind of see both trends. Yeah. And I'm just wondering if you're seeing any type of evolution on that front with your customers.
It seems to be more industry specific. Some industries and OEMs like to buy parts and others want to buy systems. And when they want to buy systems, they're expecting that supplier, that contract manufacturer, however you want to, you know, categorize it as an EMS or ODM and so on. You know, what are those relationships and how much responsibility you're going to provide? It varies widely, definitely. I mean, you know, in high tech, that's more common to have, you know, more detailed contract manufacturers that have more responsibility. In some other industries, it's not as common to go see that. So it does vary quite a bit. Now, I say from a contract manufacturer point of view, or even a general supplier, parts supplier point of view, they're looking to differentiate for the most part. Unless they want to chase cheaper labor all the time, they have to differentiate. Because if it's just about the part cost, well, then where do I manufacture that? And it's cheaper because I'm not adding any other value to it. Then it's all about labor cost and energy cost and things that go into the manufacturing the product itself. But if that's not the case, or you want to get to differentiate yourself, then you add value. So how do I add value? I do more process design. I do more maybe product design. I manage the supply chain. I manage the inventory, which is something, again, in some industries are more common than others, where the supplier is going to own the inventory until you pull it based on, you know, a Kanban type pull system, for example. So we do in general see it that the suppliers are trying to get more sophisticated because they don't want to, most of them don't want to be in the commodity business forever.
Okay. So going back then on the commodity business, the low cost supplier, we've talked a little bit about how, you know, that model, 30 years of optimization based on cost. And the minute we had that, you know, pandemic curveball thrown to us, it clearly exposed its flaws. So what's going to happen from here? Is it all about nearshoring, onshoring, friendshoring? Is it going to be a mix? You know, where do you see things going on that side?
Well, certain commodities, it's always going to be about, you know, what's the labor rate. But most things aren't a commodity when it comes down to it. And most of the costs are determined by engineering well before it ever gets out to manufacturing or supplier. So we got to be smart. I mean, companies that are designing and figuring out what they're going to go put together really have to be smart about that up front and define their core competencies and architect the supply chain and so on, as I mentioned already. That's where you're going to get the more benefit than just, you know, pushing to cheaper labor. I mean, you think about so much of the stuff was put into cheaper labor, and which is historic. I mean, if you look at, use an example for, you know, North America and producing garments, you know, you go back 100 plus years, New York City, Boston, I mean, there was the big northern cities where a lot of the garment workers were. And then they kind of moved out into more rural communities and then over time moved further south to cheaper labor and then further south or offshore. So again, all industries for the most part chase cheaper labor if labor is really the only component. Now, as more complex the products become, the labor actually is not the cheapest component anymore. And it's really more about the engineering and getting it designed right the first time. So I think ultimately, as hopefully as well. Now I say hopefully because a lot of management still kind of thinks about it's all about money. It's about optimization, and optimization is not just about money. It's maybe, you know, from an end-to-end perspective it is, but it's not just a supply chain optimization. It's really end-to-end optimization. So I think right shoring is really what people should be discussing. You know, what from a strategic point of view, a criticality point of view, I mean, it's different ways of describing it. Some of it, I think countries have to decide that as well. Some countries have decided, hey, I'm going to keep certain industries because they're important for my safety, my health and safety. I mean, there's different factors. And encouragement, I would suggest, is needed to balance that correctly. You know, I'm into, you know, everyone needs to build up an economy. That's what makes people happy, people are fed, and there's usually more stability in it. So, but it's about balance. And I think companies have to think the same kind of way is, if I want to balance and guard against disruption, what can I put up with? You know, how far can be something to be shipped? Because shipping, you know, is pretty standard now. We know what that's going to take, but then you throw another monkey wrench in it, like a pandemic, and there's different shutdowns and closings and other things. I realize, okay, it's not as consistent as it could be or as it used to be, so to speak. So again, I have to figure out what's my how much tolerance can I deal with, basically, or risk can I deal with, and then write an engineer for that. And again, look at where are those constraints, how much risk am I willing to deal with? I don't want to hold a lot of inventory, because historically in manufacturing, what we did is held a lot in inventory. And you think back to the days where in automotive, I'll just give this one example here, where automotive would do the big, you know, in the US as an example, the guard against strikes, they would distribute work to be done. So not everything for an assembly line would be produced in one plant. They would produce the side panels in two different plants. They would produce this other thing in another in two different plants. And they were different plants that had different union locals. So if one went on strike, the other one probably was not on strike, because that's how they guarded against. Now, can't do that anymore because the organizations aren't as big as they used to be. And also they've consolidated for other reasons, management reasons and other things, to go streamline their businesses. But that's kind of what companies need to do now is, again, look at their network, their collaborative network, you know, and figure out how is the best way to construct that and monitor it and, of course, improve it over time.
Okay. So I like the right shoring angle here. I'm also, I don't know if I'm a fan of it, but I believe that ultimately humans have short-term memories. So they're going to right shore over the next couple of years, but then, you know, once the pandemic's in the rearview mirror, are we slowly going to creep back to a model where the low-cost producer, the low-cost supplier is ultimately the winner? Is this just a tangent and we go back to the long-term norm, or is this a permanent shift?
So I have to say something, and no offense to anyone that has an MBA, but unfortunately, we teach MBAs, which most business managements end up being, it's all about the money. And we don't teach them holistically of understanding it's about lifecycle optimization. I'm not talking about PLM. I'm talking about the management of the whole and to optimize it as a whole, because ultimately I want to invest money in my business, bring the right products to the right market, the right time, the right cost, and all those things that go along with it. And the only way I'm going to do that is to have an end-to-end perspective of it. If I'm only looking at cost, I will probably sub-optimize. So the reality is, yeah, we probably will go back, because people will again look at it. Oh, I can hit that line item on my P&L and save at 50 cents or whatever it is per part, or 0.3, whatever it is. And it's tangible. It is very tangible. And I know I can do something with it. Now, at the same time, it can add risk, and risk can add costs and disruption. Now, I think over time, if everything continues to get better, then it will be forgotten about, because we're measured ultimately. MBAs and all of us, ultimately businesses are measured on money. It's what did you do for me lately? What's the bottom line? And if I can go save a little bit somewhere else, I'll go do this. I remember an example some years ago where I was looking at a car radio, and you know, standard car radios would come from different manufacturers. And one, and I knew they, in this case example, without giving names away, I knew that the radio was built by the same company actually. But for one OEM, it looked a lot better than the other one. And I asked them, I said, why is that? Say, well, that OEM spends like an extra 3 cents. So it's a higher grade plastic, and the look and the touch of the knobs are just that little bit better. And it comes across that way. The other one doesn't care about it. So they save, like, literally it was like cents that they saved on it. But then when you, as a user, I look at it, or as a consumer, I'm like, that's, you know, I know the radio technically is the same radio, and it probably lasts the same and everything, but the look and feel is cheap on this one compared to this other one. But that's how that company was run, and they looked at it from a dollar and cents point of view. And that's a lot of companies do it that way. Now, I find longer term companies with longer term views that tend to be more usually private companies tend to be more willing to think about quality more so than just money. And they may have a couple other parts of their equation they'll look at. But I think ultimately companies need to think about optimization from an end-to-end perspective and not just dollar optimization. Because if you look at end-to-end, the dollars will come. You'll be better off. You'll sell more. Your margins will be better. All that will come. But you have to have that end-to-end view.
Yeah. So I think you already went with the answer to my next question, but I'll ask it anyway in case there's more to it. So, you know, our take again, if you are moving away from the low cost supplier, ultimately that is going to have to be pushed through to the customer, the end user, in the form of higher prices. And with all the talk about inflation and all the pushback, it's probably the last thing you want in this environment. But do you feel that there is going to be pricing power and revenue optimization opportunity that comes from having that resilient supply chain, higher quality? I mean, is this ultimately just going to be a margin improvement? Even if costs go up, revenue goes up even more?
It depends on what the product is. I mean, certain things the consumer, us as consumers, will tolerate if it's better for us. It's a better product. It doesn't break down right away. I mean, there's reasons for them. We get frustrated. Think about in the auto industry, again, another good example that most people around the world will understand is we used to have these warranties, which were, you know, maybe 50,000 kilometers, 30,000 miles or whatever, that would cover a lot of things, but not everything. And then they started pushing up to a lot of things now, powertrain and others, to 100,000 miles, you know, 160,000 kilometers. Now, that was because it gave people confidence, right? I mean, you're going to buy, especially if it was a new product, maybe from a new OEM, and you say, hey, you buy this and it's guaranteed that we'll fix it if there's any problems to it within the first 100,000 miles. And since, at least in North America, most people don't have a car over 100,000 miles anyway, you're like, okay, that's great. Now, they would have lost money, though, if it wasn't a good product, because if it was always in the shop, there's two issues with it. One, their expenses would go up. Two, you'd be mad anyway. You never buy a second product from them, even though they're guaranteed, so to speak, to be fixed for free. So they also had to design cars for better use. And the cars are more expensive, but they last longer. You're not in the shop all the time. So again, it kind of depends on the product. If it's a throwaway product, then it's about price. I mean, ultimately, it's about price. Now, I hope that people are thinking more about sustainability and some other issues, which could increase cost as well. But a lot of people don't, especially in the West. We just haven't had to, perhaps. But regulations and other things will force increased pricing because of increased regulations. And we'll have to deal with it. And it's hopefully better for everyone as a result of that. So I think there's a kind of a combination of things that we're going to have to look at and how things are positioned. You know, what's our expectations as a community of buyers, wherever we might be around the world? And what, you know, how is that communicated to us? Quite frankly, usually the cost of manufacturing is the smallest cost of all along the life cycle. So I'm saving small percentages there, really. I mean, because the cost of designing and getting to the market is usually a lot more percentage-wise. Usually by the time a product is designed and being put into manufacturing, 80% or so of the defined cost of that product has already been defined, but only 20% of the cost has been spent. So I better define it right to begin with, or I'm not going to save much. I mean, really going to a cheaper labor doesn't do much. It may, again, I go from one that was, let's say $10 an hour and one that's $5 an hour. Okay, for a period of time, I'm going to save some money, but then that economy is going to build up and it's going to be competitive sooner or later anyway. So then I'm chasing, again, cheaper dollars and it doesn't end.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So if 80% of the costs are in the design and the upfront, you know, one of the trends we see is this huge distribution of teams. It's not just your, you know, manufacturer who's offshore now. We've got team members all over the world, and it's just because that's where they want to work from. So is that going to make that 80% bigger, or are companies finding a way to use remote teams in a more efficient way to bring that 80% of their cost structure down?
We really haven't seen much of a change with that, because you think about the development cycle, you know, figuring out and development cycle, I'm talking about even concept development, you know, marketing, you know, figuring out, you know, what should I bring to market? What is its characteristics? Then, of course, doing the product engineering, the manufacturing engineering. There's a lot of work that goes on there. I think distributed, we've been forced to, again, the challenge of distributed work has been an opportunity to figure out, which hopefully will allow for better balance for individuals as well and for companies. I think some companies will force people back to work, so to speak, in sight that haven't already, because they just want to see the whites of people's eyes when they manage it. They manage by you being there, not necessarily by the what you deliver. But I think, you know, smarter companies are realizing that there's certain expertise in certain areas of the world, certain things that they want to do, especially if they're an international company to begin with. And, you know, a lot of the collaborative type technologies, data management technologies, workflow technologies, and others are to the place where they're enabling the right kind of collaborative platform to support that type of work. So if you're smart about it, it can be better and actually can make you smarter. So yeah, it still may be 80% of the kind of cost, no more, maybe no less, but actually you get a better product down. Your total cost of ownership might be cheaper in the end because you're getting the right people to work on it. So you're kind of, that's kind of a right shoring type mentality. And definitely think that's a positive thing for many companies, not for all companies, but for any companies, it can be very powerful for them to do things right the first time, each and every time.
Yeah. So, I mean, it just sounds like the more you invest in that upfront process and get that right, that's where the true cost savings is here.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So last thing I want to dig into, this is all great in terms of how we build it, how we, you know, source it, but how about when it comes to forecasting that demand? And I don't expect anybody would have foreseen, you know, again, the impact that the pandemic had. But outside of that, are we getting better at just forecasting what our customers want and when we need to build it and when we need to deliver it? Or is this still a struggle?
Well, I think for most it's still a struggle. However, I think we have a better appreciation of it, and there's better tools to go support it. So forecasting historically has probably been more of an art than a science, but with big data analysis and analytical tools, you know, machine learning and other things that can be better predictors of the future needs based upon changes can go a long way of getting it better. You know, making it more of a science than art. There may be still an art to it, because some of the things, if I'm introducing a new product category, it's never been done before. Is there something similar to it or not, which may or may not be? I mean, so you almost have to just get it right. And some companies have been very successful at bringing a new market category or developing a new market category or a new product for a new market category. But you know, if you have something and you say, okay, well, what's going to change? You can think about, again, pandemic, okay, it rolled out and impacted the world very quickly. Then the question was, well, how long is this going to last? Now, the last time we had a global pandemic like that was, 1912, you know, the Spanish, what we typically call the Spanish flu at the time. Okay, that went through three waves, and that went through three waves over about 2-year period. Now, did anyone think that this was going to be similar? I don't know. Yeah, some people did, and some people certainly hoped, and most of us hoped that it wouldn't. So it's like you're sitting there at the time, and you're like, okay, what could happen? So, all right, now I can simulate and say, okay, if it stays in place and we still have this work from home and travel isn't encouraged anymore for a period of time, then what's going to increase? Well, again, bicycles, home equipment, home gym equipment, and so on. But then I have to decide, all right, what am I willing to bet on that? Am I willing to bet that's going to last long enough for me to get my money back because I'm going to increase certain buying and certain production facilities and other things to do that? Or am I just going to max out what I have because I believe it's only going to last 6 months? But even if it lasts 2 years, maybe that's fine, because again, I don't want to have to invest millions of dollars into facilities and purchasing that, you know, even if it's 2 years, I'll never recoup some of it. So yes, it's getting better. There's a lot more tools to support it. But the reality is, it's still about simulating the what ifs, which again can help. And this is where digital twins can come involved, by the way, especially digital twins for your logistics, your supply chain, and production. And one of the things we're seeing applied to this in some of our clients is saying, okay, if I have to change production because this component is not available, what else can I use my production facility on? And do a lot of what if scenarios. So in those cases, again, it's getting to be more of an analysis that can be done on data than just, you know, a gut feel. And there's a lot of opportunities there, certainly in a lot of companies, to do a much better job there to understand their supply chain and be able to better model it so that they can understand forecasting in a way that is more predictable.
Anybody you think is doing this really, really well that you know, we should be looking at as this is our North Star for how we should all be doing it?
Probably that I can't really mention names necessarily, but nothing really, be honest, nothing really comes to mind. There's some pieces of it here and there, and some of the clients we work with, we tend to work with kind of Global 2000 and quite consistently, and we work with a lot of smaller companies too. And there is this group that's called, there's a professor in Germany, I apologize, I forget the gentleman's name, but he talks about the hidden champions. These are kind of mid-market companies that, unless you're in their industry, you would never heard of them, right. But we all know of them. And then what I mean by that is we probably bought something from them at one point, something that we have came from them, but we just don't know. They're not a household name, but they're a champion within their area and their business. Those are the companies that kind of do this best, because going back to earlier comment about focus, you know, the core competency, they own their industry, whatever that is, either in a region or maybe even globally. And you'll see this, this gentleman, this professor I saw present some years ago in Wuhan, and no, I was in Wuhan at the time, it was in Nanjing, China. And in the Chinese, this is the entrepreneurial nature of China, is to build out the entrepreneur in these mid to small companies that will grow. Very true about North America as well, historically, Europe as well. And the gentleman, again, professor from Germany, the German economy has been very strong, mainly because of the hidden champions, because there's a lot more of those. And I think that's true, I believe, from his analysis, also in North America, especially in the US. And there's other economies that are kind of looking at same structures, like in China, for example. Those are the companies that typically do this better because they're focused. It's not so spread out that you can't even think about a multivariable equation. What happens if you have a multivariable equations and there's multiple variable equations? It gets exponentially complex. But if you focus, you can do a better job in forecasting and managing complexity and change.
Okay, great. Well, we've reached the end of our time. I think we could probably go on talking for hours on this. Really, really love to hear your insights. Peter Bailello, again, president and CEO of Cimdata. If anybody wants to check it out, it's cimdata.com. And Peter, if anybody does want to get in contact with you, how should they reach you? Should it just go to the website or? Just
go to the website or p.bailello@cimdata.com or info@cimdata.com. reach out, and happy to talk to you more about this topic. And Dario, thank you very much for the invite. Appreciate it. I enjoyed the discussion.
Yeah, thanks so much, Peter. We always appreciate your insights. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Platform Rules Digital Transformation for Product Companies. You can listen to this show and more at propelplm.com/podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard, please share with a colleague, leave a review, or email us at podcast@propelplm.com with any feedback or questions. Until next time, Platform Rules.